I was originally going to call it Solving M-Theory with a Conformal Bootstrap, but I thought that might be too pretentious. But one of the things I want to convince you is that that's actually no more pretentious than the excellent papers titled Solving the Ising Model with a Conformal Bootstrap. I'm going to attempt to convince you that in the same sense that those landmark papers solve the Ising Model, we have, in exactly the same sense, solved M-Theory. So if you like one, you like the other. So let's start by reviewing precisely what people meant when they said they had solved the Ising model. So like, what does it mean to use the bootstrap to solve a CFT? So there's two basic ways that one claims to solve a CFT with the bootstrap. The one way is computing islands. So in particular, when people were looking at the Ising model, which in fact, in general, they were looking at the ON model, where we can think of n equals 1 being the Ising model. And then people also did this for the n equals 1 Ising model with n equals 1 supersymmetry. So in all these cases, people would look at mixed correlators. And the reason why they looked at mixed correlators is that they wanted to have access in the OPE to all the relevant operators of these theories. Because part of the definition of this theory is that there's only a small finite number of relevant operators. So after looking at mixed correlators and imposing that only these operators are relevant, they were then able to compute in the space of the scaling dimensions of these relevant operators, say one of them being sigma, another one being epsilon, some kind of small island, which usually takes roughly this shape. So just a couple comments about these islands. Firstly, it's important to note that you can only get islands on the relevant operators and not on any other operator in the theory. So like sometimes people think that like, oh, if you have an island, then that just means the whole theory lives in the island. But it's only the relevant operator scaling dimensions that are bounded in this way. If you were to look at any other operator in the OPE, such as say like a spin 2 operator, a spin 10 operator, you would just get the usual upper bounds. So while these are very powerful results for the relevant operators, it's somewhat limited to just like these scaling dimensions and their OPE coefficient. Another comment to make is that sometimes people think that looking at more correlators just automatically vastly improves the bootstrap, and in fact, that's not the case. So if you do mixed correlators, and if you don't impose these gaps, then the bounds you get are exactly the same as the bounds of just a single correlator, which is either good or bad, because either it shows that you don't have to look at that many correlators, or alternatively, it's bad because it shows that you can't just improve things by just arbitrarily including more correlators. One more comment, which is something I'm going to be comparing to once I get to M-theory, is that when people created these comments, when people created these islands for the ON models, so they had some kind of archipelago-type plot where you could compute the relevant operators for all the different ON models. And so say you have like the Ising model here, and then you would have like the O2 model, which would be a much bigger island, and the O3 model, like, they're not that close to each other. And then the O3 model, which is an even bigger island. And so what they were noticing is that the islands were growing with n, and growing quite rapidly. So to give some precise numbers, so let's define the percent error of one of these scaling dimensions in a very simple way. So it's just the upper bound minus the lower bound divided by the average. This is what I call like percent error. So the percent error for the Ising model, so for the O1 model, for this lowest dimension scaling dimension, delta sigma, was 0.004%. And then for the n equals 2 ON model, it's 0.12%. And then for the n equals 3 ON model, it's 0.24%. And so, I mean, all of these are pretty accurate. I mean, these are all very nice small islands, but it is true, though, that they are definitely increasing. And so if you were to want to use the numerical bootstrap to study, say, like the O100 island, which I don't think anyone has ever bothered to do, that would probably not be a very good island. At least in the reasonably small n range, they're definitely increasing. Okay. At least if you want to study n equals 8, let's say, it's probably going to be bigger than these small values of it. So these are all the comments I'm going to make about these very beautiful results, which were computed by the authors who everyone knows. So No need to measure. The second method, that's exactly the next thing I was going to talk about. So this is the first method of how people solve CFTs, by computing small islands. The second method, which people use to solve CFTs, as Slava has suggested, is the extremal functional. So the extremal functional method is based on the idea that there should be a unique solution to crossing at the border of an allowed region. And so you can motivate that your theory lives on the border in several ways. So historically, the first way that the icing model authors did this is that they assumed that CT, which is this number which is proportional, at least in bootstrap terms, to the stress tensor OP coefficient squared, inversely proportional. So they assumed that this quantity is minimized for the icing model. And so they would compute a bound on this CT, and then they would look at the functional, which was extremizing it, and then they would just assume that that is the correct functional for the icing model in the limit of infinite precision. And then you can read off all the CFT data that appears in that four-point function. A similar idea was used later, not by minimizing CT, but instead by looking at the boundary of the island. And so that's just like another way of assuming that your theory saturates an allowed region and then reading off the extremal function. So the extremal functional, the advantage it has over islands is that now you can access all the CFT data. So like in particular, with the conventional bootstrap without any assumptions, you could never bound operators unless they're the lowest dimension operator in their given sector, just by like how the bootstrap is set up. So in fact, the only way to look at those operators is by looking at the spectrum, and then you could look at, in principle, as many operators as you want, although precision usually limits it to the lowest few twists. So that's a huge advantage that the extremal functional has over islands. The disadvantage is that it's not rigorous. So what do I mean by rigorous? So like one of the big advantages of the bootstrap over other techniques such as epsilon expansion is that we know that it improves. So we know that as I increase the number of derivatives that I'm using to compute this plot, the island must get smaller and smaller. This is something you can't say about perturbative expansions. Like, if I compute the 6 epsilon expansion for the icing model, it could be that it will be worse than the 5 epsilon expansion. And this is a very important aspect of the bootstrap, one of the most important. And this is something which you just can't say about the extremal functional method. Like, if you compute a spectrum with n max equals 10 and a spectrum with n max equals 15, it's impossible to say that one is better than the other. I mean, it's always just, it's more of an art than a science. Now, it's an art that works quite well. So when people looked at the extremal functional for the icing model, they were able to compare some of the CFT data that was read off with, for instance, epsilon expansion, or perhaps even Monte Carlo in some cases, and it does seem to match. So it does work, but it's just not as rigorous. Another lack of rigor is that, of course, you don't know rigorously that the theory is saturating the bound. This is always a conjecture. And so this is a very reasonable conjecture, but it's not something you know. Whereas with these islands, there's no assumptions. I mean, in principle, the IC model could be anywhere within here. We're just saying that it's a very small region where it could possibly be. So this concludes the discussion of the two general methods that people use in order to say they've solved a CFT. So if we're able to get a really tiny island and then look at the spectrum in that island, and then we can get very good numerical evidence for all the low-lying operators in a CFT. And then we say that we have solved this theory. And so I'm going to now show that you can do this for M-theory, in particular CFTs that are dual to M-theory. OK, so let's start by motivating the CFTs we're going to study and why we care about them. So we, in particular, are going to be studying 3D maximal SUSY theories, where max SUSY, in technical language, is that it has n equals 8 supersymmetry. So let's start by just talking about the known theories in this class, because in fact, there aren't that many theories which have maximal supersymmetry in 3D. So they're all described in the same basic setup. So they're all Chern-Simons matter theories, which have two gauge groups. And then they have bifundamental matter. So that means it's in the fundamental of one gauge group and in the antifundamental of the other gauge group. So in particular, there's three families. There is the ABGM family, which was discovered by Aharoni, Bergman, Jaffris, and Maldacena. For this theory, the gauge groups are both UN, and they have Chern-Simons coupling K and minus K. The second family is the ABJ theory, with the same authors, just minus Maldacena. And this has UN plus one, as well as UN. And the, and also with, sorry, and this has Turn-Simons level. And the third family is the BLG family, where this has gauge groups SU2. And one more comment is that for the ABGM theory, if you want to have maximal supersymmetry, K must equal only one or two, whereas for this BLG case, K can equal any natural number. So this is the complete list of known 3D n equals 8 theories. There could well be more theories. There's no proof that this is the complete list, but these are the only ones that we know of so far. One more comment is that these BLG theories for small k are in fact dual to ABGM theories. So I'm not going to give all the precise dualities because it's not so important, but the, just the thing to keep in mind is that when k equals 1, 2, 3, or 4, then it's dual to various ABGM theories. Whereas for every other value of k, it's not dual. And that's something we actually know. So why does one care about these 3D n equals 8 theories? They just seem like very complicated theories so far. So the reason why you care is that they're related to quantum gravity. So in particular, if you have M theory on ADS4 cross S7 mod ZK, then this is dual to ABJM theory, where I'm going to label these theories by their value of n and k. I'll put n on the bottom, and I'll put k on top. In particular, another way of looking at this is that it's a theory of n coincident M2 brain on either flat space or modded out by ZK, where KK can be either 1 or 2. And so as usual, in the case of ADS-CFT, if we let the rank of the gauge group become big, then we can study these theories by looking at weakly coupled supergravity on ADS-4 cross S7 mod ZK. But you don't have to let N be big. In principle, the strong version of the ADS-CFT duality claims that these theories are in fact dual even for small n, although that's obviously something which is harder to show. So one of the kind of, I guess, grand goals of the conformal bootstrap in the holographic perspective is to be able to study holography when n is finite. So you no longer have to limit yourself to just perturbative in n. In principle, you should be able to study like 5 M2 brains in flat space. And so I would say that this is the main motivation for why one is interested in studying these maximally supersymmetric theories. Although, even if you don't care about holography, you should still be interested in these, simply as just another example of a very simple theory where you can compute tons of precise islands. So for those who don't like holography, just keep that in mind. One more comment to make, which is kind of related to this holography story, is that for the ABJM theories, you can understand them as the IR limit of super Yang Mills with various classical Lie groups. So for instance, if you have super Yang Mills in the IR with the UN gauge group, then this flows in the UV with the UN gauge group, then this flows in the IR to the ABJM theory with k equals 1. Similarly, if you have the SO2N gauge group, this is going to flow to ABJM with k equals 2. And then lastly, for SO2N plus 1, this flows to the ABJ theories with n. And so this is kind of one of the reasons why you might suspect that there could be more 3D n equals 8 theories out there. Because after all, you might ask, what happens if I have a UV super Yang Mills theory with like E8 exceptional group? What does that flow to in the IR? And the answer is we just don't know. So like it could well be a new 3D n equals 8 theory, but we have no methods in order to study it. So this is like another thing which in principle the bootstrap could teach us about, like more 3D n equals 8 theories that we don't understand yet. Okay, so this is kind of the general story of known 3D n equals 8 theories and their collection to holography. So now I'll just write some like very basic technical facts to keep in mind about them, which we will use for the bootstrap. So the first fact is the global symmetries of this theory. So they have SO8 R symmetry, which is why we say they have N equals 8 supersymmetry. So this is the global symmetry. If we now look at the spectrum of operators, so we are mostly going to be interested in the most protected operators, what are called half BPS. And the half BPS operators, they transform in a rank Q traceless symmetric, a rep of SO8, with dimension delta equals Q over 2. So let's give some examples. So when Q equals 1, this is just a free multiplet, right? So this is the dimension of the bottom component of this multiplet, of course. Because like this multiplet has many operators in it, and I'm labeling them by the bottom component, which is a scalar, which is the simplest operator. So when Q equals 1, the bottom component has delta equals half, and that's just the free theory. Very simple. When Q equals 2, this actually is the stress tensor multiplet. So the top component of this multiplet will have dimension 3, spin 2, and it's the stress tensor. So every interacting theory has this Q equals 2 operator, and only the free theory has the Q equals 1 operator. The last case we're going to consider is Q equals 3. So there's no special name for this operator. But what's nice about it is that it doesn't appear for all of the known 3D n equals 8 theory. So in particular, it does not appear for the K equals 2 ABGM theories. So it does not exist for K equals 2 ABJM. Also does not exist for BLG except K equals 3. And so you could check this just by trying to like construct these operators, you know, using fields, you know, from the Lagrangian. Alternatively, you can understand it from the holographic perspective because you're modding out by the Z2. And when you mod out by the Z2, it kind of kills all of the odd BPS operators. Yes? You're saying, how do you know the fact that this operator doesn't appear? You could try to construct the operators using fields in the ImageM Lagrangian, and you'll... Yeah, but, I mean, but like, I mean, okay, so... Okay, I guess you're saying because like you need to have some kind of like weak. This is the idea: is that you're building these n equals 8 operators by combining monopole operators as well as fields from the Lagrangian, and you just don't have the right monopole operators to construct these fields, except when k equals 1. This is the same reason why the supersymmetry is only maximal when k equals 1 or 2. Like when it's smaller, it's no longer maximal. Okay, so I've said when this operator doesn't appear. Maybe I should say when it does appear. So it does appear for k equals 1 ABJM when n is greater than or equal to 3. So again, you just can't construct the right monopole operators except for that case. And so the nice thing about this operator is that if you bootstrap a four-point function which involves this operator, then you're automatically killing most of the families of these theories, and you're kind of like focusing on the one specific k equals 1 ABJM theory. These are some of the basic technical facts. Now let me tell you which four-point functions we're going to study. So we're going to study four-point functions of the stress tensor multiplet. So I'm going to denote these operators just by their value of Q. So I'm just going to call the stress tensor multiplet 2. And then we're also going to look at some four-point functions of the 3 half BPS operators. And in particular, we're going to do mixed correlators. But before we move on to mixed correlators, we're going to start just with the four-point function of the stress tensor multiplet, because that is the simplest case. A couple more comments before we go into the details of the bootstrap. So with these known theories, you can see that you can label them by their value of n as well as their value of k. In fact, there's a theory-independent way of measuring, of labeling a theory, which is simply the value of ct, which I guess I wrote down before but erased. So the value of ct for any theory in any dimension is always just 1 over the stress tensor multiplet OP coefficient squared. This is something you can just show from conformal word identities. That's why it always holds. And so you can always label a theory by its value of CT. And so this is how we're going to label these theories. And in fact, we know how CT is related to N and K. So in particular, for ABJM theories, in the large N limit, It takes the relation ct goes like n to the 3 over 2 times square root of k, along with some numerical factors. In fact, you can also compute ct for small values of n and k and for BLG. You can compute it for any theory. But for our purposes, the most important thing to note is just that it grows with n, which is what you would expect, because ct is roughly a measure of how many degrees of freedom you have, as is n. So this is what we're going to use to label theories, is ct. And then one last thing is that it's always useful to look at limits of theories in which they're exactly solvable, such as the free theory. And so for our 3D n equals 8 theories, there are two solvable limits. So the one limit is the free theory. So that's just the theory generated by this dimension half q equals 1 operator. And so for the free theory, you can just construct every other half PPS operator out of the free half PPS operator, and then just do Wick contractions. The other case that one can compute exactly is a certain generalized free field theory, which corresponds to the n goes to infinity limit of ABGN. So this is a generalized free field theory because the stress tensor operator does not appear. But it is like a free theory because you can still compute everything with Wick contractions, and all the scaling dimensions are just fixed. This n goes to infinity limit is just supergravity in the holographic picture. But you don't have to think of it in the holographic picture. You can also just think of it as like the infinite n limit of a theory. Kind of like analogous to how in the ON vector model, you also have an infinite n limit in which you can compute everything, but it's not a free theory because the operators don't take free theory values. Okay, so in these two limits, you can compute everything, and this will kind of serve as kind of like the boundaries of our plots. So when we plot things, we're going to plot them starting from the free theory. So the free theory has ct equals 16. And then we're going to plot them going all the way to the generalized free field theory, which has ct goes to infinity. That's why it's useful to plot things in terms of 1 over ct, because then they'll go from like 0 to 16. So that's going to be the ranges of our plots. Okay, so now let's discuss the conformal bootstrap for just the single correlator of these stress tensor multiplet operators. In order to do that, we need to discuss the operators that appear in this OPE. So you don't need to understand so many details. There's just a couple things you need to know. So let's look at the operators that appear in the 2 cross 2 OPE. So first of all, we have one long operator. So this isn't protected by supersymmetry at all. The only thing we know about it is that its dimension is bigger than its spin plus 2. Then we have some operators that are called semi-short. They have either 1/8 or 1/16 BPS. This one is called a plus. This one is called a 2. The names don't really matter. What's important about them is that their spin is fixed. Sorry, their dimension is fixed. So in both cases, the dimension is whatever the spin is, plus 1. Sorry, plus 2. But these exist for all even spins or all odd spins. So for the first one, it's all even j, and for the second one, it's all odd j. And this is going to be very important, the fact that we have an infinity of these semi-short operators. So these guys is what I call semi-short. And then lastly, we have some short operators. These are protected by even more supersymmetry. So either they're quarter BPS or half BPS. The quarter BPS one we call B2. It has dimension 2. It's a scalar. The half BPS one we call B plus. It also has dimension 2, it's also a scalar. And then of course we have the stress tensor multiplet itself, which we'll just call stress. As a reminder, that has dimension 1, and then we have the identity. So this is the complete list of the operators that appear in the OPE. And the ones we're going to be focusing on is either the short category or the semi-short category. And so all you need to remember is that short are scalars, and you only have a couple of them, only 2. Whereas semi-short can have any spin, either odd or even, for each kind of operator, but its dimension is fixed. And so these are going to be the heroes of the story. These are going to be the main things we're studying. So how does one actually do the superconformal bootstrap? So it's not that different from the regular bootstrap. So people in the audience who have done the regular bootstrap, they don't need to be nervous about the fact that there's the word super involved. It's basically the same idea. So the way it works is that, as usual, you expand your four-point function in terms of blocks. Except now you have a different block for each supermultiplet. So let's label these OPE coefficients by supermultiplet M. And then we have these super blocks also labeled by M. And these super blocks are simply linear combinations of regular blocks. Let's call the regular blocks lowercase. And so this is a sum over just the operators that appear in the supermultiplet. And this is exactly what you would expect, because a supermultiplet is just a combination of regular operators. So to a super block is just a linear combination of regular blocks with coefficients that you can fix. So in practice, if you want to compute a certain superconformal theory, you have to compute the super blocks. You can fix these coefficients, let's call them A, using superconformal Ward identities. So in our case, the N equals 8 Ward identity for half BPS operators was computed by Dolin, Gallo, and Sokachev. And so it takes the form of a very simple differential equation. There's no need to write it down. And so all you do is that using group theory, you figure out which representations appear in each supermultiplet. You plug in an ansatz of those blocks into the superconformal Ward identity, and it fixes the coefficients, and then you have your super blocks, and that's it. And then you can just bootstrap as usual. So the technicalities, so conceptually it's quite simple, just technically it can be kind of difficult computing these super blocks because they can be very big and complicated. Another subtlety which happens when you have lots of supersymmetry is that it can reduce the number of independent crossing equations. So usually, as everyone in this audience is probably aware, when you bootstrap just a non-supersymmetric theory, the number of crossing equations is kind of related to how many representations show up in the OPE. So for instance, if you're bootstrapping the group SO8, it's similar just to SON when N is at least 3. And we're bootstrapping a rank 2 tensor in SO8. And so there's 6 representations that show up. And so this means you would have 6 crossing equations. And so this is what you would have without supersymmetry. But due to supersymmetry, this is actually reduced to way fewer crossing equations. So one more thing I need to mention is that in the bootstrap, you expand your conformal blocks in terms of derivatives in Z and Z bar. And so that's how we're going to count the number of crossing equations. And so after imposing supersymmetry, you have one crossing equation which has derivatives in both Z and Z bar. So this is just a conventional crossing equation. And then you have another crossing equation which only has derivatives in Z, but not in Z bar. So you could say it's like holomorphic in these derivatives. And so the number of crossing equations that only have derivatives in Z is actually way fewer than derivatives in both. Because of course you could have like cross derivatives usually, which you can't have in this case. So like the point is that due to supersymmetry, this is basically a one crossing equation problem. One crossing equation and chain. And so comparing to the Ising model, we see that the 3D N equals 8 theory is basically the next simplest theory. So even if you hate supersymmetry in holography and like you turn off your ears the moment you hear those two words, you should listen up again when you learn that there's basically one crossing equation. So this is like the second simplest theory that you could bootstrap in 3D. This is just even aside from what you can learn from it, this is just kind of like a technically nice thing about it. Okay, so this is all the setup you need in order to do the bootstrap. Then we can just do the bootstrap as we usually do, computing both upper bounds on the scaling dimensions of long multiplets, as well as both upper and lower bounds on the scaling on the OPE coefficients of these short operators. And so this is actually, it's very important that you can compute both upper and lower bounds, because this is something you can't do when you don't have supersymmetry. So generically, for like say the Ising model, if you were to want to compute a bound on CT, you could only compute a lower bound, or maybe it's an upper bound, one or the other. You can't get both an upper bound and a lower bound because there's a continuum of operators above the stress tensor. Trying to do like the wrong bound would just violate the rest of the assumptions of the bootstrap. It's only when you have a gap in between operators that you're able to compute both upper and lower bound. But the nice thing is that this gap is automatically given to you by supersymmetry because these operators have their dimension fixed. And so they come at fixed intervals. And so in fact, for any superconformal field theory, you can always compute both upper and lower bounds on the protected operators. And that's where our islands are going to come from. Because an island is just an upper and a lower bound. So before we talk about these OPE coefficient bounds, let's first talk about the bound that you get for the scaling dimension. So we're going to plot things in terms of 16 over CT, such that the free theory is at 1, and the supergravity theory is at 0, because it has CT goes to infinity. And then we're going to plot the scaling dimension of the spin zero long multiplet. And so you can plot this thing, and it looks roughly like this. So it kind of goes down, and then there's a kink. And this kink happens at the value of CT roughly 22.8. So this is a very mysterious value, because this value doesn't correspond to any known 3D n equals 8 theory. And so, in fact, like you might look at the theories that appear next to it. So like the theory that seems closest to it has CT equals roughly 21, but it's not 22.8. And you could check with very precise numerics that it doesn't like converge to anything close to 21. Like it's really just 22.8. And so this is something we noticed 5 years ago when we first created these plots in our very first 3D n equals 8 bootstrap. And to be honest, it remains a mystery to this day. The other bounds you can compute, and of course this thing starts at 2, which is the value you expect at n goes to infinity. So the other bounds you can compute are upper and lower bounds on protected operators. So here, the x-axis is 16 over CT. Here we're going to put an OP coefficient of a certain protected operator. It doesn't matter which one, because they all kind of look the same. And again, you get an upper bound, and you get some kind of lower bound, which has a kink at the same value of 22.8. So all our plots have a kink at the value of 22.8. And one nice thing about these plots, well, this really meted a point, is that we know the value at n goes to infinity, and we know the value at the free theory, and indeed, they go to the right values. I mean, this is just a sanity check, because like the theories are solved there. But not only do they go to the right values, like the upper and lower bounds coincide at those points. So in a sense, like the numerical bootstrap is perfect for the mean field theory and the free theory. Unfortunately, we already know the answer. So, but like that's just another nice consistency check. And these bounds are actually quite narrow, these upper and lower bounds. And that's important because now, as long as you have an upper and lower bound on a quantity, you could just plot one of these protected OP coefficients versus another protected OP coefficient, and that would be an island, right? Because it's an upper and lower bound in a two-dimensional space. So this is almost a trivial exercise. I can plot one protected OP coefficient versus a second protected OP coefficient. I'm going to get some kind of island, just like the icing model. And these islands are, in fact, quite precise. So to give some examples, so if I look at this A plus operator, and if I look at spin equals 0 and spin equals 2, and for this purpose, let's just choose a random value of CT. So let's say like CT equals 50. Then the upper and lower bounds give me an island, which is precise to, in this case, it's 0.5%, and in this case, it's 0.3%, which is basically comparable to the islands that people got for the ON model. Even the most precise islands, like from the most up-to-date, you know, precision ON model bootstrap, those islands are basically as precise as the islands that we basically had 5 years ago. Yes? Sorry, the size here is supposed to shrink? Well, no, it could shrink because, so like, I'm facing the value of CT. So that's what I said. Like, I'm saying, let's say I'm looking at A plus. Let's say I'm looking at CT equals 50, for example. So then, I mean, as far as I know, there's just one theory with CT equals 50, and so it really should fit. Now, okay, I think what you're referring to is that the general class of 3D n equals 8 theories is, from the numerical perspective, kind of like a conformal manifold. Because, like, even though in reality the value of n must be an integer, from the bootstrap perspective, n could just be any real number, and so you could say that there's almost like a conformal manifold with one moduli, so to speak. But the thing is that we fix that moduli by fixing the value of CT, which is the same thing as fixing the value of n. Okay, so this relates to the first way of solving a theory, which is that you can get really tiny islands, and the islands we get, what's nice about them is that we get them not just for one theory, such as like say the n equals one icing model, we can get them for an infinity of theory, because we can get these islands for any value of CT. And so this corresponds to all the infinity of possible ABJM theories, BLG theories, you know, et cetera. Yes? Okay, so that's a good question, and I'm going to address that in 5 minutes. So you're going to see the answer to that. Yeah, so because like in principle, both of these points are within this allowed region. And so I guess you could say that like even with infinite precision, maybe you wouldn't expect that this would shrink to exactly a point because there would have to be, I guess, at least maybe two theories. Although by the same token, it's not guaranteed that two theories can have the same value of CT. It could be that only the k equals 1 theory can have CT equals 50, and the k equals 2 theory just like never has that value. Sure, yeah. I mean, if you treat it as n is continuous, then yes, yeah. But like, I guess for actual physical theories, you wouldn't have to worry about that. Okay, but that's a good point, and that's something which I'm going to address in a moment. Okay, so one more comparison to the Ising model is that if you compute these islands, you can see here already from this plot that as n is growing, so n is growing in this direction, that the islands are actually getting smaller and smaller. And so this is kind of the opposite of what you see with the ON model, where it seems like the islands were getting bigger and bigger. Now, of course, Slava has reminded me that once n is sufficiently big, the ON models do get smaller. But I guess one advantage of these three n equals 8 theories is they're basically always getting smaller, except in this region, but there's no known theories in this region anyways. So we can kind of forget about this region. Well, I guess there's one. I mean, there's like this one theory with CT roughly 21, but other than that, there's no known theories in this region. And the free theory, of course. Okay. So far, I've discussed basically the results from 5 years ago. There's one more part of this story, though, which is very important. And this is the 1D topological theory. So this was something which was originally shown by me, Silviu, Ron, and Jehoon, inspired by a paper by Leonardo Rastelli and collaborators. And the statement of that, I'm not going to go into the technical details because that's not important for our purposes, but the basic idea is that if you have a theory in 3D with at least n equals 4 supersymmetry, then from the n equals 4 perspective, the half BPS operators are described by a 1D topological theory. So from the 3D n equals 8 perspective, an n equals 8 operator is half BPS from n equals 4 as long as it's either half or a quarter BPS. So for our n equals 8 theories, which is what we care about, we know that any half or a quarter BPS operator is in this topological theory. So what are those operators? Well, let's just look at this list. It's just these operators. It's all the short ones. So it's the identity, the stress tensor, what I call B plus, and what I call B2. And so what it means that only these are described by the 1D topological theory, so this means that if you start with a four-point function in the 3D theory, and then if you perform this topological twist, so originally this thing was a sum over all the multiplets. So this was a sum over all the multiplets with all their super blocks, including the infinity of long multiplets and semi-shorts. But once you go to 1D, then this same four-point function now only has four operators that appear. And not only that, but the position dependence all vanishes. And that's why you call it a topological theory. So in particular, you're going to get something like the identity. You're going to get some number divided by CT, because that's the stress tensor multiplied by OP coefficient. You're going to get some other number multiplied by the OP coefficient for the B+. And then you're going to get another number multiplying the OP coefficient for the B2. And then there's also some flavor dependence, but I don't want to go into that right now. And so what's nice about this is that for the 3D theory, to impose crossing, this is a super hard problem. In fact, that's the entire point of this talk. But for the 1D theory, imposing crossing is super trivial. Like, basically, all you do is you interchange the flavor symmetry indices, which I'm suppressing, and it just gives you one crossing equation. So this one crossing equation is simple. It's so simple that I'm actually going to write the equation, because this talk mostly doesn't have any equations. But this is one equation I will write, just because it's so nice and simple. So you can read it even with my bad handwriting. So this is the 1D crossing equation. It's just like various numbers multiplying the only quantities that you knew could appear. And this is an exact non-perturbative statement about any 3D n equals 8 theory. Yes? Okay, exactly. That's the next thing I was going to say. You're always anticipating me. Okay, so this is maybe historical, because this was the first thing we computed. In our original paper, was just this 1D crossing relation, and what's nice about this is that it basically says there's one independent OPE coefficient. Let's call it this one, because like this was the other one, but we can write this in terms of CT as well as that, as well as just the number 16. Okay, great. As Davida has anticipated, you can actually do better. So in a later paper, not with me, but by Pufu, Dedoshenko, and Jacobi, they derived a Lagrangian for this 1D theory. A Lagrangian, obviously, for a given theory. So, for instance, they derived it, for instance, say, for the ABGM theory with k equals 1. And so this is a Lagrangian which you can use to compute these OP coefficients that appear in this topological sector. And so you can just do the computation, and the answer is in terms of an n-dimensional integral. So for instance, the OP coefficient squared of B2 is some n-dimensional integral. And so for small n, you can just do these integrals, and this allows you to know the exact values of these OP coefficients. And the answers are quite non-trivial. Like, it's not just like 1 or something. And it doesn't just like truncate at like leading order in 1 over n, as happens, you know, in other chiral algebras in other dimensions. So this is what you can do with this Lagrangian. This is already very nice, but the problem is that, say we want to look at the large n regime, because that's the regime that's like related to holography and related to weakly coupled supergravity. You can't do that with these integrals. The integrals get too big. But then comes to the rescue the wonderful Fermi gas people. So this was developed by Putrov, Mourinho, and in particular, we used a paper by a guy named Nosaka. And they used something called Fermi gas. I'm not going to give any details because it's outside the scope of this talk. But what they show is that you can compute the mass deformed three energy on the three sphere. And this actually, due to localization, is the same thing as on the one sphere in the 1D theory. So this is the 3D case. This is the 1D case. And you can compute these things to all orders in n, so to all 1 over n orders. So you can basically, you know the answer to this mass deformed free energy exactly, except for some non-perturbative correction. Now, then what you can do is that, so what is this mass deformed free energy? Like, why is it useful? So if you take derivatives in terms of mass, if you take n derivatives in mass of this mass deformed free energy, then this gives you a correlator of n stress tensor multiples. Now, the reason why is that the stress tensor couples to mass when you deform the Lagrangian. And so it gives an integrated correlator, in fact. And so because you know the mass deformed free energy to all orders in n, and because this also applies to the 1D theory, that means you have one constraint to all orders in 1 over n. But we only have one independent thing that we want to compute, because we already related these two things with the 1D crossing, really. So that's why it's actually useful to have this 1D crossing. And so what this means is that we have these OP coefficients, lambda b2 and lambda squared b plus, to all orders in 1 over n, which is something you should really appreciate. I mean, it's super difficult in quantum field theory to compute any quantity to all orders in perturbation theory if it's non-trivial. I mean, of course, there's hundreds of trivial examples where it just truncates at leading order. But this is an example where it is truly non-trivial to all orders, and you can compute it exactly. I'm not going to write down the full answer because it's very complicated, but just to give you a flavor, it's written in terms of Airy functions. So you can Wikipedia Airy functions, and you can get a flavor of what this answer looks like. So, so this is the other ingredient which we can now add to the bootstrap. So for any 3D n equals 8 theory, we have this 1D crossing relation, and in particular for specific theories such as ABJM, we can compute these OP coefficients to all orders in 1 over n. So one brief comment about BLG is that for BLG, the rank of the gauge group is just 2, so then you can just do the integral. You don't need some like fancy Fermi gas for that. In fact, there is no Fermi gas. So at the end of the day, for all the known theories, we can basically compute these protected OPE coefficients. And in fact, this 1 over n expansion is super, super precise. So just to do a comparison, so like you can compute the exact answer for n equals 2 for, say, the B plus OPE coefficient. And you find that the answer is 12.8. And then you can take our approximate version for large n, so the 1 over n answer, and the 1 over n answer is 12.7982, dot, dot, dot. So this is crazy. It's like you take this analytic answer, which is an Airy function, you plug in n equals 2, which is the smallest possible value you would even care about, and it's basically as accurate as the exact answer. So it means these non-perturbative corrections are quite small, which is lucky for us. Great. Okay, so now let's use these analytic OPE coefficients and let's compare them to the bound we had. And so in order to do that, I'm going to violate Slava's rules and show one plot. And it's a plot about holography and supersymmetry. So he's going to especially hate it. Yeah? Sorry? Well, okay, I mean, the inversion formula is only useful if you already, if you've, like, computed some four-point function. Like, inversion formula is, like, you have a four-point function you know, and then you can read off CFT data from that. But, like, I mean, we already know the free theory and the mean field theory, but for every other theory, we don't know the four-point function. So it's not so useful, in, well, at least from my understanding. Okay, so here's this wonderful supersymmetric holographic plot. So let me explain it. There's a lot of stuff here. So firstly, let's look at the black lines. So the black lines are the numerical upper and lower bounds. The x-axis is usual 16 over CT, and the y-axis is one of these protected OPE coefficients. So the reason why there's dotted lines as well as solid lines is that just as we improve the precision. So just to get an idea of like what region the precision is better. So you see that the precision is actually better for large n versus small n, which is kind of curious. And also, it seems that the precision is kind of uniform for the upper bound, whereas for the lower bound, that's the one where it kind of differs for small and large n. So these colored dots are values of the OPE coefficient computed exactly, you know, for small n, or for BLG, you can do it for any value of k. So for the BLG theories, they just seem to be somewhere within the allowed region. In fact, it seems like they go to the upper bound. But whatever, like, we don't care as much about BLG. More interestingly, for the ABJM theories, I actually said that once when Lambert was in the audience, I didn't know. So you have to be careful. So for the ABJM theories, you have these all orders in one over n answers, and so that's where we're plotting these lines. So they all start at n goes to infinity. And very interestingly, they're basically saturating the lower bound. And so to address DeVita's question from before, he was like, well, don't you have these different theories? Shouldn't they appear at different points within the island? And so what's kind of fascinating is that these lines seem to be almost identical. So a couple comments about that. For the two k equals 2 theories, i.e. the green ABJ as well as the gray ABJM with k equals 2, perturbatively in CT, those are actually identical. So in perturbation theory, these are identical. The only difference is non-perturbative, because they both have k equals 2. So for those, I guess you expect that these lines should be identical. But what's non-trivial is the fact that the k equals 1 theory is different from ABJ and ABJM. So it's like you can barely see the difference. It's like you have to look super closely, and then they start kind of diverging over here, if you can see my mouse. One more comment is that I mentioned before that BLG for low values of k is dual to ABJM, and you just see this on this plot. So like, you know, you can compute the using different methods, but you get the same answer because they're dual. And so the only cases where BLG is close to saturating the lower bound is when it's dual. So this motivates the conjecture that, and this vertical line is just the mysterious 22.8 value. So this motivates the conjecture that one of these ABJM theories is saturating the lower bound. So when we created this plot, we didn't know which one, because all these lines were so close. But we just suspected it was one of them in the limit of infinite precision. Now, I wouldn't worry about the fact that the lines get a little bit further as n becomes smaller, because as you see from the numerics, that's when the numerics is worse. So it's reasonable that with infinite precision, all these lines would be super close, you know, throughout this entire region. Okay, so that was the big result from my first paper with Nathan and Sylvie, which is called Solving M-Theory. And now that you know that this analytic quantity is basically saturating the lower bound, for whichever theory is saturating, you can use the extremal functional method to read off the spectra. So previously I spoke about islands, and I said how the islands for 3D n equals 8 are as good as the Ising and ON model islands. Now I'm going to talk about the extremal functional method, and I'm also going to tell you that the extremal functional method is as good for 3D n equals 8 theories as it was for the Ising model and the ON model. So you can read off all the low-lying CFT data, and this includes all of it, like including the non-protected CFT data, which is really the non-trivial stuff. Like, for instance, the scaling dimensions of the long operators, in principle, if you know those for huge twists, you could somehow relate those to black holes. So like, I guess this would be kind of like the long-term goal to understand that kind of CFT data. And so you can just do numerical fits. So like, for instance, you could look at the extremal functional, you know, plot this as a function of 16 over CT, because we have like a different functional for every value of 16 over CT. And like, you're going to get some line, because it's just like a functional, like it's not a bound anymore. And for very large values of n, you can do a linear fit. And so we did these linear fits. We actually originally did them 5 years ago just based on the upper bound, but then we later on did them once we had this extremal functional. And we, of course, just get like random numbers. And these numbers are predictions for what the 1 over CT correction should be to various CFT data. So for instance, you could look at the scaling dimension of the spin zero operator. So it has like leading order disconnected term two, and then it's plus some number over CT. So in particular, this number is minus 109. You can also do this for spin two, in which case this would be four, and then we got minus 49 over CT. And we did this for everything. I'm just not going to list them all because I don't want to bore you guys. And then after we made these predictions, so without cheating, people then computed these 1 over CT corrections using basically supergravity. In fact, they were using the analytic bootstrap, which is an easier way of doing supergravity, but you might as well just call it supergravity because it involves some assumptions that require that it be supergravity. So this was done in this wonderful paper by Sheenan. So he did it for the spin zero operator, and he got an answer, which of course is analytic. So he got something like minus 1120 over pi squared, and then this is roughly minus 113.48. So this is already a pretty nice match. You know, this is like a prediction from 5 years ago, and then this is a calculation from last year. And then what I did in a follow-up paper is that I computed the rest of the CFT data for all the operators, both semi-short, protected, as well as higher spins and higher twists. And so, for instance, for spin equals 2, what I found was minus 5948 over 35 pi squared, which sounds like a totally crazy number. What could it possibly mean? But if you put it into slash n in Mathematica, you get minus 49.9311, which is really incredible. I mean, like if you thought this match was good, this match is like too good. And in fact, then you get all the matches are excellent. So this, in fact, was the worst match. Every other match is like completely spot on. And so this is like, so sometimes people say like, okay, you claim to be solving M theory, but like, what have you learned about M theory that you didn't know before? So this was an example where the bootstrap predicted a value, which was later computed using quantum gravity and a match. And so this is an example where we learned something new about quantum gravity. Now, eventually we were able to figure out what it was in quantum gravity because we figured out how to do the supergravity calculation. But it took 5 years from when we first wrote this paper in order to do that. Okay. And we can do even better than this, because like so far I've been listing lowest twist operator. And so lowest twist operators from the perspective of the extremal functional are somewhat less interesting, because you could have got bounds for those even without an extremal functional. You could have just maybe assumed that the theory saturated the upper bound or something. What's more non-trivial is the operators that you could only get from the extremal functional, which are the non-lowest twist, the higher twist operators. So I also computed those in my paper. And one technical difficulty that occurs is that if you want to compare the extremal functional answer to an analytic answer, so let's look at the, okay, so basically for the lowest twist operators, there are no degeneracies for these. So like these are like double trace operators. But once you go beyond lowest twist, degeneracies start occurring. And so in order to unmix these degeneracies, you would have to compute a whole bunch of four-point functions and do a diagonalization procedure, such as what has been done for n equals 4 recently. So that's very hard. But one kind of trick you can do is that you already know with intuition from n equals 4 that the difference between the average anomalous dimension and the actual anomalous dimension for all the degenerate operators is down by 1 over spin. So if we look at a really high spin operator, then for these high spin operators, we can be pretty safe that just comparing the average to the lowest one will be pretty accurate. So this is what I did. So in my paper, I computed just these average anomalous dimensions. So let's give the answer for delta 10. And so I'll put a prime, because this is the second to lowest spin 10 anomalous dimension operator. This is some number, and then plus a correction, 1 over CT. So this is the thing I computed. I computed, again, it's some crazy number, but I'm going to write it so you can appreciate how hard it was to get this. It's minus 619440 over 1001 pi squared. It's like, how the hell do you know this thing means anything? You put it into Mathematica, it's minus 62.6997. And then from the extremal functional, you can just read off this operator. So this is the average value. Let's put an average here. And so from the extremal functional, you can just read off the lowest of these degenerate operators, and you get minus 60. So this is like a pretty good match. And this is like really strong evidence that this XML functional is actually working. So as I said before, the XML functional is an art, but it's a pretty good art. And so for the icing model, you had kind of checks that these non-lowest twist operators were matching, and so too for the 3D n equals 8 theories. In particular, the ABGM theories, we have these checks that the XML functional is actually working. Okay, so one more comment. All these calculations, all these analytical calculations are 1 over CT, and to leading order and 1 over CT, these apply to all ABGM theories. Because to leading order, they're all just described by the same four-dimensional supergraph. So you can't distinguish between k equals 2 or k equals 1. You certainly can't distinguish between ABJ and any of the other ones. In order to distinguish between these different theories, you would have to look at sublinear corrections. Those would depend on k. And so that's not something which I think the numerics are precise enough to really distinguish yet. And instead for that, that's why we're going to now look at the mixed correlator bootstrap. So I've concluded the discussion of the single correlator bootstrap. You can see that we got islands, we got an external functional, and as of yet, there was still a mystery of which theory is actually saturating the bound. Is it ABJ? Is it k equals 1? Is it k equals 2? There's also this like annoying fact that these free theories are coming up and we don't want them, but they're just there. And all of these are going to be resolved once you do the mixed correlator bootstrap. So remember from the beginning of the talk, you shouldn't just do mixed correlators for the sake of it, because then you're wasting your time. Maybe 10 minutes? Because I started late. 7, okay. So for the mixed correlator bootstrap, so we're looking at these mixed correlators of the 2s and the 3s. And there's three reasons why this is worth it, why it's not just like a tedious exercise. So the first reason is that this automatically kills the k equals 2. We don't have to worry about k equals 2, and so that means we no longer have to worry about this ambiguity between ABJM and ABJ. The second nice thing is that in the 2 cross 3 OPE, the 1 appears, i.e. the free theory, we can just kill the free theory by setting its OPE coefficient to 0. So that's another nice thing. Thirdly, there's way more short operators. So there's now 10 short operators, which is more than the 3 short operators we had before. And so because we can compute these short operators exactly using the 1D theory, it's just always better to have more short operators. So this is the three reasons why it's better. The reason why it's harder is you have to compute way more blocks. They're mixed correlator blocks. You again have to find the independent crossing equations. So in this case, you start off with 34 crossings. And then after supersymmetry, you end up just with like 7 Z and Z bars, 7 just Zs, and 7 ones of which you don't take any derivative. So that's just kind of a curious fact. So it's basically 7 crossing equations. So now let's list the results. First of all, you can just do a bound on CT once we've killed the free theory, and you find that CT is roughly greater than or equal to 22.8. So our old friend 22.8 shows up again in a very mysterious way. So somehow this is the lowest possible value for this mixed correlator system where I've killed the free theory. So if anyone in the audience can think of why that is, it would be great because we don't understand why that is. The next thing you could do is that you can bound the scaling dimensions. So I'd like to show another plot. Here I'm going to show you the plot. Can you show the plot? Hello? Oh, great. So you can show the plot for the scaling dimension bound. So here I compare the single correlator bound to the now mixed correlator. So the gray dotted line was the old single correlator bound. As you see, it has a kink. The red line was the linear fit we were doing before. The black line is the new mixed correlator bound. And so as you can see, it's slightly stronger in this region. And then it gets drastically stronger here, where it goes to 1 at this value of 22.8, because this is 16 over C. So this is telling you that this 22.8 is somehow associated maybe with the free theory, because the scaling dimension seems to be going to 1. But more interestingly, you've just shown that for the bootstrap that applied to k equals 1 ABGM, it was stronger than the bootstrap which applied to either k equals 1 or k equals 2. And so this means it could not be the case that the k equals 1 ABGM theory was saturating the bound from before. So we've disproven that option. And so we've now shown using mixed correlators that it could only be one of the two k equals 2 theories that is, in fact, saturating the bound. And of those two theories, we, in fact, kind of know which one it is, because for ABJM with k equals 2, and when n equals 2, this is a product theory. So this equals 2 ABJs. And product theories also can't saturate the bound. So basically, at the end of the day, we've shown that ABJ is the theory that was saturating the bound for single correlators. That means we can, in a sense, solve the ABJ theory. The other thing we can do, so I'm going to show one more plot, is that we can, again, compute islands by plugging in all these protected operator OP coefficients that we can compute using the topological theory. So I'd like to show one more plot. This is the last plot. And so this is the M-theory archipelago. So far, I'm only showing you N equals 3, N equals 4, as well as the mean field theory. That's because in this mixed correlator case, we can only compute the OP coefficients for small n by doing these integrals. We no longer have this trick using Fermi gas yet. We think that should be possible in the future. But so far, we're just computing them exactly. And as you see, this is an incredibly small archipelago. So this is basically as accurate, perhaps even more accurate, than the ON model bootstrap. Great. So that's it. Maybe I'll just give actual percentages. So just to give some numbers, so for n equals 3 and spin equals 0, we have 0.3%. And then for spin equals 1, we have 0.1%. And then for n equals 4, for spin equals 0, we have 0.25%. And for spin equals 1, we have 0.08%. So 0.08% is kind of the nicest one. And so you see this pattern where the islands are getting smaller as both n grows and spin grows. So the basic conclusion you should keep in mind is that we can compute islands for an infinity of theories for any value of n. And for each value of n, we can also compute an infinity of islands, one for every single semi-short operator, which appear for an infinity of spins. So this is infinitely better than the ON or Ising model bootstraps, where you could only could compute islands for basically the relevant operators. And so I guess that's kind of like one of the main takeaways. I can briefly talk about future directions. One obvious future direction is to compute, in the mixed correlator case, all these OP coefficients to all orders in 1 over n by generalizing the Fermi gas calculation. This is something I'm working on with some people at Weitzman right now. If you could do this, you could then get these tiny islands using the mixed correlators for any value of n. And these islands you know would apply to the k equals 1 ABGM theory. Additionally, if you had these OP coefficients for any value of n, you could compare them to the numerics, to the extremal functional, and then we could get a really nice extremal functional using these mixed correlators, which again we would now be applying to the k equals 1 ABGM theory, as opposed to the single correlator case, which we now know is ABJ. So maybe ABGM k equals 1 sound more interesting than ABJ. Lastly, one more comment about actually learning stuff about quantum gravity. So again, the cynic might say, okay, you have all these random plots about a CFT. What is this telling me about black holes and stuff I care about in quantum gravity? So the most basic quantity in quantum gravity is an S matrix. So you have like four gravitons going in and they're interacting. And this is the most basic quantity in flat space quantum gravity. So for instance, in M theory in 11 dimensions, you would want to compute this thing in an expansion in Planck length. And people only know how to compute the first three terms. So the first three terms here, people could compute using dualities and supersymmetry, but you can't get any of the higher terms even in principle. And so a way you could actually compute this is that if you can compute, so this thing is related in the flat space limit to the four-point function of the stress tensor multiplet, or in general, any half PPS operator four-point function in ABGM theory. So if you can compute this that quantity, so for instance, if we can compute 2, 2, 2, 2 in a 1 over CT expansion, then as many orders as we can compute, we can take the flat space limit, and we can now know the answer for the M theory S matrix. So this is something we've already done analytically for the lowest two terms. This was based on a paper with Shi Yin, Sylvia Pufu, and then another paper with Thamen Binder and Sylvia Pufu. But we don't expect the analytic results to be able to go beyond the first three terms. You're going to need something unprotected. And for that, you're going to need the bootstrap. And so the eventual goal is we're going to use the numerical bootstrap to precisely constrain this four-point function in the large n regime. We're going to be able to fix as many coefficients as we want, and then we'll be able to compute the M theory S matrix to as many orders as we want, which is truly, I would say, solving M theory. OK, that's it. Question? Uh, Well, I guess, in the flat space limit, I guess this would correspond to scattering of more gravitons, which is something people have studied.
I just meant here you look at the mixed quadrator,
Oh, you're saying doing mixed correlators with more of these half-PBS operators? So the biggest advantage comes from looking between 2 and 3, because like that allowed you to kill the free theory, and it allowed you to kill the k equals 2 theories. If you were to include 4, for instance, then like it would give you more short operators, you would have more things to impose, but there would also be way more crossing equations, and it wouldn't give you anything else which is really qualitatively new.
Because you would be inputting more and more information.
You would be putting more and more information, but at the same time, the number of crossing equations grows, and so that means like the precision of the bootstrap would become harder and harder. So in the long-term future, that would obviously be better. So like, you know, if you could do infinite precision bootstrap, you might as well include as many correlators as possible, because you can input infinite information. But in the short term, the real advantage was by looking at 2 and 3. Yes? So I didn't mention that detail. In the original paper from 5 years ago, we used NMAX 10. That was done with SDPA in those barbaric times. And then in the more recent paper, we used NMAX 22 for the single correlator and NMAX 18 for the mixed correlator. But we didn't use any of the new fancy like Wolter SDBB stuff. So like presumably with that new technology, we could go to like way higher precision. Should be something nice to do in the future. Sorry? The scaling dimension of the unprotected? Yeah. I mean, those are the plots. I was showing those plots. So, like, that was the plot I showed. I mean, so for instance, here is one of the plots I drew. So, like, you get an upper bound. I also showed the upper bound you got for mixed correlators. I also showed you can get this from exponential functional. Yeah. Sorry? Well, no, you can't get islands there because you can only get islands in scaling dimensions if you could assume some gap above them. But like, we don't know the gap. I mean, if you impose some random gap, you can get an island, but like, I don't like unjustified gaps. You're saying at the kink? Yeah, so I mean, I looked at it kind of briefly, like nothing really kind of jumped out. One thing which does happen at that kink is that there's the B2 short operator goes to zero. So I guess you could say the B2 operator decouples. You don't need to look at the spectrum. You can just like look at the bound for the B2 operator. You see it goes to zero. So that's one explanation of why the kink is happening. But I didn't notice anything else in the spectrum that was particularly striking.
So a lot of the techniques used to be applicable to the kink of course.
So for 3D n equals 4, it depends which operators you look at. So like, if you do a four-point function of half-PBS operators, it would be applicable. So that would be like the moment map operator. So like there would be dual, I guess, to like vectors. It wouldn't be dual to like gravitons anymore. And so indeed, that would be an interesting case to study. You would have to. I think even the pseudo-Vermeer entities are known in that case. And also, I guess you would be able to have a 1D theory, and you'd be able to use these Fermi gas results also, yeah. So this is something we kind of looked into briefly analytically, but we haven't done any numerical
work. Probably n equals 6 would be more
interesting. Yeah. So n equals 6 is something we are working on, and it is indeed interesting. Because in that case, you have string theory, M theory, and higher spin theory all in one CFT. So you could say, like, bootstrapping all of quantum gravity. Yeah. There just is no, I mean, like, there is no perturbative thing to do, right? Because, like, so, like, for the exceptional groups like E8, like, what would you be perturbing in? Sorry? Oh, okay, so that's a good question. So SB is kind of related to the SON groups. So it's like it flows also to the K equals 2 ABJ theories.
I mean, the whole 1D story.
That's true, yeah, but the yeah, but the thing is, but if you want to write down the 1D Lagrangian, though, you don't know what that is.
There's also a problem with that. Actually, I don't know if any swarming mills itself can be used.
Yeah, it's hard to do localization for pure super-Yang mills because it diverges. Like, yeah, because like you can't even compute the index. Like a basic question, you could be like, what operators appear for the E8 theory? We don't even know that.